When I was coming out of ninth grade, I was in Lebanon, and I went on a CIT trip. It was a trip to Niagara Falls, and it's pretty close to Rochester. We stayed in Rochester overnight, and one of the highlights of the trip, probably one of the few things I actually remember, is the morning after we davened chakras, before we headed out for about an hour away from Niagara Falls, we were zocha to have a little schmooze from Rabbi Schaefer, who at that time was a Rebbe in Rochester, I guess was there over the summer. I tell you, even though then I was coming out of ninth grade, I still remember what Rabbi Schaefer spoke about, and it wasn't even about Taibu. I had a chavrusa, Rabbi Chaim Juni, in Queens, who said he went to Rochester with a major attitude and no interest in learning, and he was put into Rabbi Schaefer's shir. Rabbi Schaefer whipped him into shape and really got him into learning, and he's been learning ever since, and attributes that to Rabbi Schaefer. Rabbi Schaefer now is involved in the shmooze, as I'm sure everybody's well aware, and they're very powerful, inspiring things that he brings out of the Chazal, which is really having its effect worldwide, and we have a tremendous host today to hear from Rabbi Schaefer.
The Beis tells us, Tana Rabbanan, Lasid Lovo, at the end of a person's days, Ani v'Asher v'Rasha, a poor man, a wealthy man, and a Rasha born Ladin will come to judgment, and Hashem will answer them if they'll have tainas. Each person will have a taina. The Ani will say, I didn't learn. The Asher will say, I didn't learn. And the Rasha will say, I didn't learn, and each one will have a reason. The Ani will say, listen, I was poor. And poverty means I literally couldn't put food on the table. I had to work not 14 hours a day, 16 hours a day. I really couldn't learn. The Usher will have a tremendous taina. Listen, the entire world was waiting at my footstep. There were 20, 30, 40 mishulachim a night who would come to my door. I had 700 employees. How could I learn? And the Rasha will have his answer as well. And interestingly enough, the Gemara says that Hashem will answer them. But Hashem won't answer them by saying, you're wrong. Hashem won't turn to the Rasha and say, you're a liar. The Gemara tells us that Hashem will tell them the following. Each one has an individual answer. Says the Gemara, the answer to the Ani is, you are no more poor than was Hillel. And then the Gemara tells us exactly the event that happened to Hillel. And I want you to hear carefully how the Gemara describes it. Gemara tells us that Hillel was a tremendously poor person. Every day he would gather a little bit of kindling wood, he would sell for a topic for one small coin. That coin, half of it he would use to feed his family, and the other half he would use to pay the Shomer Beis HaMedrash. It was a guardsman who protected the Jews from the various goyim around there. You had to pay him a fee, and half of that coin went to pay the guardsman. One day, Erev Shabbos, Hillel was late, he didn't have time to gather the kindling wood that he normally sold. Memela, he didn't have that small coin. He comes to the guardsman and says, please let me into the Beis Medrash. And the guardsman said, no. Please, no. Please, no. At which point the Gemara says, Hillel said, how could I leave Divrei Elokim Chayim, the words of Shmaya of Avitalion? And the Gemara tells us that he climbed up to the roof. There was a skylight, and he listened to the shear from that skylight. Gemara tells us it was Tevis, it was the winter time, it began snowing, it's not clear whether he fell asleep, he passed out. In any case, he was under a pile of snow the next morning when Shmaya of Avitalion came into the Beis Medrash, and they looked up and saw in the skylight the image of a man. They said to someone, quick, go up there, get him down, get him down. And someone went up, brought him down, and they said the following, Roy Alav L'chalas HaShabbos, for this man it fit to the Mechal HaShabbos. They lit a fire to warm up some water to dethaw him. Says Gemara, if the poor man comes to Din and says, Hashem, couldn't learn. I literally was so poor, you were no more poor than was Hillel. He learned, you could learn. Nein Gemara tells us they say a similar story but different to the usher. If the wealthy man says, I was too busy, I had the entire city waiting for me, Gemara says, you were no more wealthy than was Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim. And then the Gemara tells us the story of Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim. Says the Gemara, when Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim died, his father left him 1,000 boats and 1,000 cities. Keep in mind, in the time of the Gemara, if you were the landlord, you literally owned the land. You made the laws, you set the policy, it was your land. He was such a phenomenally wealthy person when his father died that the Gemara gives it, I assume it's a guzma, 1,000 yachts and 1,000 cities. Says the Gemara, he had no involvement whatsoever in all of his nechassim. He had no involvement to the extent that he would take just his daily food, walk to the Beis Medrash, and he would go from place to place to learn. He never stepped foot into the business. Ad kidei kach, that the Gemara tells us, an event that happened to him. One time he's walking through one of his own lands, and as he goes through the lands, two people stop him and say, Chai Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim, in the name of Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim, you must work. The tax that you had to pay in that region was you had to work a few weeks for the landlord. And he said the words, please, I want to go to the Beis Medrash and learn. They said, no, in the name of Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim, you must work. And the Gemara tells us he worked as a day worker for 2 weeks. And Marshal is bothered by the question, why need to say, what do you mean? I am Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim, I am the landlord. And Marshal explains that no one would have believed him. Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim is this wealthy man, this chashuv man, and this poor person, there's no way you could be Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim. He had to work on his own land, says the Gemara. When the usher says, I was way too busy to learn, they say one thing, you were no busier than was Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim. If he was able to learn, you were able to learn. And that's the Gemara. And I was open to hear the Rishiva ask two penetrating questions on this Gemara, and that is rather obvious. This Gemara is talking when we leave this earth. You and I are here for a few short years, but at the end of our days, every one of us will stand in front of the Beis Shemala and will answer for everything that we did. Here, I could fool you. You could think one thing, you could think another, but you don't know who I am. This Gemara is talking when I leave this body. The body's dead, I stand in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Hashem knows the emes. Hashem knows exactly where these people are. Why didn't Hashem just say to the Oni, you're lying? You're not telling the truth. You could have learned. Why didn't Hashem just answer the usher? You weren't that busy. You could have learned. Why did Hashem need to bring these mashalim, need to bring Hillel and Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim? That's question one. And question two is that they are irrelevant. Hillel was a unique individual in history. One time in the course of man's existence, there was a man as great as Hillel. What does that have to do with me? How could you be Machayev the Oni to be like Hillel? I'm judged not according to you, you're not judged according to him. I'm judged by the most demanding standard. They hold up a picture of me and they say, why didn't you become that? But what relevance does Hillel have, and what relevance does Rabbi Elazar bar Charsim have? So the first question is, who needs them? And the second question is, what relevance do they have? And I'd like to see if we can answer these two questions. And to do that, I'd like to share with you an interesting mashal. One of the great milestones in competitive sports was the 4-minute mile. For decades, literally for decades, everyone assumed it was a given fact, man could not run a mile in under 4 minutes. As a matter of fact, literally, for over 100 years, that stood as an absolute unpenetrable barrier. In 1923, Paavo Nurmi of Finland ran it in 4 minutes and 10 seconds. It took 11 years to get it even nudged down. In 1934, an American, Glenn Cunningham, ran it in 4 minutes and 6 seconds. In 1945, Gunger Hag of Sweden lowered it to 4 minutes and 1 second, and it remained stuck. There was no way that man could run a mile in under 4 minutes, and people offered all types of reasons. Man's skeletal structure is all wrong, his lung capacity is too small, the body shape creates too much wind resistance. It was a given fact that no man can run a mile in under 4 minutes. One runner, John Landy, ran the mile in 4 minutes and 2 seconds 4 times. Time after time, he got stuck at 4 minutes and 2 seconds, and he said the words, it's a brick wall, it cannot be penetrated. On May 6, 1954, Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. Then, amazingly, within 46 days, John Landy, the same fellow who called it a brick wall, not only broke the 4-minute mile, ran it faster than Roger Bannister. Within a year, 37 runners did it, Within 1 year after that, 300 runners had broken it. That 4 minute mile, which was the absolute brick wall that couldn't be broken, once one man did it, 37 men did it, then 300, now any decent college runner can run the mile in under 4 minutes. But here's the observation: nothing changed. They didn't assume a new diet, they didn't train that, change the training, they didn't put on new types of running shoes. And the only thing that changed was Roger Bannister took something from the realm of impossible and made it possible. Once one man broke through that brick wall, 37 men, then 300, it became doable. And I think in life, if you study the way people act, there are these things called limiting beliefs. Limiting belief is a powerful force that keeps people shackled to it. It can't be done. It's impossible. I'll give you a mushroom. In some parts of Asia, the beast of burden is still the elephant. And you could see pictures of this elephant lugging huge logs and going through the thick undergrowth, a powerful beast. And every night, they tie this powerful behemoth up to a very small peg in the ground. And if you look at the pictures, you'll say to yourself, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense. And that animal is huge. The rope is thin, and the peg is small. Why in the world doesn't it escape? And the answer is it can't. But the reason that it can't escape is not that it physically can't escape. It can't escape because in its limited understanding, it can't do it. You see, when that elephant is born in that part of the world, at birth it's about 250 pounds, and what they do is they tie it to a stake in the ground. When the elephant is a baby, it physically can't escape those bounds. It's bound to a peg in the ground with a thin rope and tries to escape, tries another time, and eventually it learns that it can't break those bonds. And then for the rest of its life, it's bound to that little peg and it can't escape. A grown elephant weighs 14,000 pounds, can pick up a tree trunk weighing 4,000 pounds, but it's bound by a thin rope to a peg in the ground because in its limited understanding, it can't do it. And many, many people are bound by limiting beliefs, certain assumptions about who I am, my background, where I'm coming from. I can't do this because that's the way it is. In 1997, in Tallahassee, Florida, not that far from here, an event made the headlines. A child was trapped under a car. They immediately called for the EMTs, the fire department, but no one could save this child because the child's arm was trapped under the wheel of a car. On the scene, a rescuer, for some unknown reason, whom no one recognized, runs over to the car, literally grabs the fender, lifts the car up, the child escapes and saves the child. This made the headlines, not just because a human being lifts up the fender of a car, because who the human being was. The human being was this boy's grandmother, who was 63 years of age, who had never picked up anything heavier than a 50-pound bag of dog food prior to this moment. And Dr. Charles Garfield, who wrote a book called Peak Performance, who studies various tremendous feats of strength, decided he must interview this woman. He read about her. Her name was Laura Schultz. He traced her down and he put in a phone call to her, expecting that she would, of course, return the call. She didn't. He called again. She again avoided his call. Time after time, she wouldn't answer his calls, and he became fascinated by why doesn't this woman want to speak to anyone about it. Finally, he persevered, and he gained an interview with this woman, and he describes that when he spoke to this woman, as interesting as the story was why she didn't want to speak to anyone about it. You see, Dr. Charles Garfield, when he sat down with her, asked her that very question. Why is it that you're so reluctant to speak about this? And she said the following: if what this is true, that I couldn't do this in my mind, but obviously I could, what does that tell me about the rest of my life? What does that tell me about everything else that I thought I couldn't do, and I really can? Dr. Charles Garfield, being a psychologist, played the role of coach, and he asked her, so what is it that you want to do? After a few conversations, it came out the fact she felt frustrated, she had never gotten beyond high school, and she always wanted to go to college. In the end, Mrs. Laura Schultz went to college and began teaching college level science by the end of her career. And here's the point: everyone understands that it's physically impossible for an older woman to lift up a car until that reality changes. And everyone knows that the elephant is tied to the peg in the ground until there's a fire in the circus tent, which happened in 1944 in Hartford, Connecticut, when the Barnum and Bailey circus tent burned down. And in the pandemonium that ensued, the elephants broke out, and those elephants had to be released. They could never train those elephants again. Because of the smoke, the fire, the excitement, the elephants broke away from their bounds. They forgot that they were limited, and they escaped. Once they escaped, they could never be tied again to those pegs. That entire herd had to be replaced. And that's how Rosh Hashanah answered this Gemara, that in life, we need heroes. In life, we need images of people who reach tremendous heights. They shatter our limiting beliefs. And once there's a Roger Bannister who can break that 4-minute mile, then 37 people can do it, then 300 people can do it. And once a woman lifts the fender of a car, then it shows if that's what she can do in this area, what could she do in everything else? It shatters our limiting beliefs. I believe what Rosh Hashanah was saying was quite simple, and that is the Ani had a very good taina. He really was too poor to learn. Until once in history there was a man who shattered that belief. There was once a hero far more poor than you, and look what he accomplished, look what he became. There was once a Rabbi Elazar ben Chayyim who could have been as busy as you, surely was more wealthy than you are, and he accomplished. If he could do it, you could do it as well. And that's why Hillel was Machayev Yaniyim. That's why Rabbi Elazar ben Chayyim is used as the message for the yeshiva. I was a young man learning in Forest Hills in the yeshiva, and the yeshiva spoke about Musa Chaburas. Musa Chaburas, then the yeshiva explained to us, was a small group of like-minded fellows who got together to work on an issue. For some reason, I was zocha to be part of a very chashuv group, and each week somebody in the group would be asked to present. So one week a guy would bring in a raya from a Tosas, he'd bring us a certain event that happened, and you bring a proof to what an area one has to work on. Another week somebody brought a pasuk in Chumash with Sifon on it. Each week people would present their different stuff. Okay, my week came, and I showed up to this Musar Vad, not with a Chazal, not with a Gemara, not with a Chumash. I showed up with a picture book of boxing of Muhammad Ali. I had been a fan of Muhammad Ali as a kid, and I brought this picture book of Muhammad Ali's fights, and I put it on the table. Now these were a chashuv group of guys, and I got some pretty dirty looks, as in like, Schaefer, what's the deal you get with the program? And I put the book down, and I opened it up to the fight between Frazier and Ali the third time around, when Ali won. And Ali is holding up the heavyweight belt, arms raised up high, and I said to the guys, what do you see? And those looks turned to scorn, when this better be good for me, but what's the point? And I said, guys, what do you see? We get it, we see he's a heavyweight champion of the world. What do you want? I said, that's wrong. That's what they show you in the picture. But what you don't see, and what they don't tell you about, is that Muhammad Ali was driven from that fight directly to the hospital, where he spent 3 weeks in a hospital bed because he couldn't get out of it. He was so beaten up in that fight that the victor, the heavyweight champion of the world, literally was confined to a hospital bed for 21 days because he suffered such a beating. But you see, you don't see that. You see him holding a heavyweight belt. You see him as a champion of the world, but you don't see the pain, you don't see the fight in the man, you don't see the amount of time that he got smashed in the head. If you know now, Muhammad Ali doesn't speak very well. He can barely hold up his arms. He has Parkinson's disease. And it's an accepted fact that the reason why he has Parkinson's disease is because he got smashed in the head so many times. But here's the point. Muhammad Ali was called Pretty Boy Ali. He was a fellow, if you remember from the ancient history, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. You'll see the fight always. The punch comes here, he moves here, he moves here. He was never hit. He was the cleanest fighter in boxing. He was never hit. Muhammad Ali once estimated that in his professional career, he was hit to the head at least 1 million times. 1 million times means a 220-pound Cairo smashes him full force in the jaw 1 million times. That's the cleanest fighter and boxer, and that's Pretty Boy Ali. And that they don't tell you about in the sports write-ups. They don't tell you about the pain. They don't tell you about the fight. They don't tell you about how much a person has to suffer to get there. And I don't know if we can learn musaf from a boxer, but maybe we can. Muhammad Ali used to sleep with his running shoes under the bed. And you know why? Because he said, if I found any excuse not to train the next morning, I would find it, I wouldn't go running. He did all kinds of things to train, and he said these words, I hated every minute of training. I hated every minute of training, but I said to myself, better to be fight now and be a champion the rest of my life. Those words are very, very powerful. Those words indicate a person who has vision, who has understanding, and knows the key to life. And that is, you have to fight, and to be prepared to get knocked down, you have to be prepared to get up off the canvas. And by the way, one more line from Muhammad Ali. He says, if you ever see a fighter who gets knocked unconscious and he's down for the count, it almost never, ever is real. He says, the concept of a professional prize fighter being knocked unconscious almost never happens. When he stays down for the count, you know what happens? He got so beat up, he doesn't have the courage, he doesn't have the heart to get back into the fight. He's in such good shape, so trained that it's almost impossible for him to be knocked unconscious. He got the fight knocked out of him. He doesn't have the guts to get back into the fight. And my friends, this concept, I believe, is a very big yesod. Because you see, after you decide that you're worthy of making yourself into something, you have to be willing to pay the price. And the price that is to be paid is not just to be up there on the front page of Sports Illustrated. The price is running hundreds and hundreds, thousands of miles. The price is getting smashed in the jaw a million times. The price is getting knocked to the canvas and getting back into the fight. And if you find me any human being who excelled in any area of life, anywhere, I guarantee that person got knocked down, got back up, got knocked down, got knocked back up again, because it's only in the fiction books that the fellow puts on the gloves and becomes a world champion without pain. In the real world, there's a lot of pain, a lot of getting knocked down, and what separates the victor from the loser is how much fight he's got in him, how many times he's willing to get back into things. I heard Rabbi Avraham Chaim Feuer be maspid his father of Gifter. And in the Hesped, he told a fascinating story. He said, Rav Gifter grew up in America. And Rav Gifter grew up like any other teenager growing up in America. And Rav Gifter had a mirror in his room. And every day, before Rav Gifter would leave his room to Beis Medrash, Rav Gifter would look into that mirror. And the only thing unusual was what it was surrounded by. You see, around the mirror were pictures of the Gedolim, Rishim Yishkop, Baruch Be'er, all the various Gedolim. And on top of the picture were the words, why not you? And apparently every day Rav Gifter would look into the mirror, look at the pictures around there, read the words, why not you? And you know what the answer to that question was? The answer to that question was, there was no why not you, because he became Rav Gifter, Telzer Rosh Hashiva, Gadol B'Yisrael. He made himself into that person. And that sounds inspiring. But here's the mistake that so many people make. In fact, most people make. They assume that all it takes is drive, enthusiasm, I'll get psyched, and I'll start learning and growing, I'll become a great person. Or I'll become wealthy, I'll work real hard, I'll make $1 million. Or I'll become a fantastic runner, a fighter, a boxer, whatever it is, all I gotta do is work real hard. And that is a fundamental error. If you would like to succeed in any endeavor in life, what you have to know is what Rav Huttner wrote in one of his letters. Huttner writes in his letters that people make that very mistake about Gedolim. They assume a Gedol is a person who began learning Shas at 6 years old, and by 8 he finished all of Bavli, by 10 he finished Yerushalmi, the rest of his life he just started Chazar. And that isn't true. Not only isn't that true, says Rav Gifter, any Gedol you'll ever find, he says, fell down and got back up, got knocked down and got back into the game, had many, many times that they got up off the floor. And says Rav Gifter, if you ever read a story about Gedolim without the struggle, without the fight, you're reading pure fiction. It's made up, it's not true. And this reality, I'm afraid, is something that they often don't tell you about when you read either the art scroll biographies or the stories of great people you may read about in the papers. The fact that they fought, the fact that they got back into the fight again and again, and at the end of the day, the measure of the man is not his talent, not even his drive, but how many times he's willing to get back into the fight and fight again. And the Rosh Yeshiva was telling us a tremendous yesod from Hillel. And that yesod is, the Oni has a very good answer. He didn't learn, not because he was a bum, and not because he didn't care about learning, but he really was too poor. And Hashem answers back, there was a hero. There was a man who one time burst through that limiting belief, and shattered through that brick wall, as Roger Bannister broke through the 4-minute mile. That hero broke through it. If he could do it, you could have done it. You had to use him as a hero. If a 63-year-old grandmother could lift the fender of a car, you can do a lot of things that you don't know, and you're limited by those shackled beliefs, like that powerful 14,000-pound elephant tied to a peg in the ground. Okay. Now, you guys may say to me, this is nice, this is interesting, but it's got nothing to do with me. And I'd like to share with you that this has an awful lot to do with you. And to explain to you what it has to do with you, let me share with you an interesting thought. I get a chance to speak in different communities, and every once in a while, things happen, and certain events sort of make me go, I was speaking in a certain community, and after I was done speaking, people came over, rabbi, very nice, thank you. At the tail end, an elderly couple came over, and the woman said, rabbi, we love the lecture. Thank you very much. Husband followed suit. Rabbi, we love the lecture, but... Now, I've been around the block long enough to know that when you hear the words, rabbi, I love the lecture, but... something's coming. What do you mean? Rabbi, I love the lecture, but... according to what you just said, I've wasted my entire life. I said, excuse me, what do you mean? He said, well, you talked about, you know, what you talked about. And what I've done all my life is worked, done quite well, made some money. I never thought about what you're saying. And according to what you're saying, I wasted my entire life. Now, gentlemen, it is a very uncomfortable position to be when you're on this side of the shtender, and an 80-year-old man is on that side, and he says, according to what you said, he wasted his entire life, and you know that he might well be correct. A very uncomfortable position to be in. And I'd like to share with you what it is that I said to give you the rest of the story. As Reverend Gita mentioned, I was a high school rabbi for many years. Every year I would begin the Musar part of the curriculum with the following question. I would ask the guys as follows. I'd say, gentlemen, tell me, why don't you sin? Why don't you sin? And I don't mean little stuff. I mean real big deal stuff. Ish, Geneva, murder. Why don't you go out there and just do whatever you want to do? So the guys would say, Rabbi, are you crazy? Hashem will be angry with me. Which point I say, so what? Many Rishonim throughout the generations have lived a very good life. Do whatever you want. At which point, at least a few of the fellows say, yeah, that's true, but my neshama is going to burn. I don't want my neshama to burn. At which point I would look the guy in the eye and say, there are many things you don't do because of this. Many things you do because of this. Listen to me very carefully. Forget about your neshama. Don't worry about your neshama, and don't do anything you don't want to do because of your neshama. You take care of you. Let your neshama burn. Why should you suffer? And why should you work so hard so your neshama should have a good time in Gan Eden? Take care of you. Do whatever you want to do, and let your neshama burn. Now, gentlemen, I always stand by the door during that point. I never let anyone leave before I answer. What is the answer to this? Rasul Salanta says that the difference between me when I'm alive and me when I'm dead is very simple. If I walk into the room and I take off my jacket, I emerge. And says Rasul Salanta, that's the difference between a person when he's alive and when he's dead. As I speak to you, I think, I remember, I feel. The body is buried in the ground, and I, the one who told the arms to move, told the legs to move, separate from the body, the body's put in the ground, and I live on forever. But you see, it's not my distant cousin, not my alter ego, not my neshama that goes up there, it's I. You see, I stand in front of the Beis Din Shamala, and I answer for every conversation, every action, and I answer for what I accomplished in this world. Not some scaled down version of me, not some neshama-y kind of thing that doesn't relate to me, I, the one who'm speaking to you. And gentlemen, this concept is very, very hard to understand. And very, very distant, even though it may sound simple. I'd like to share with you that 99.9% of the occupants of this planet don't get this. Want a proof? Go to a basic chorus. go to a cemetery, you'll see all over the place the words "at rest." You'll see it in the footstone, you'll see it in the headstones, "rest in peace," "he's at rest." Never. Poor Harvey, Harvey's at rest. I'd like to share with you what "at rest" means. Imagine you break your arm, and throbbing pain, and you take Tylenol, Tylenol, codeine, you take Percocet, nothing helps. Throbbing pain, finally 3 o'clock at night, oh, you fall asleep, Baruch Hashem, your arm no longer bothers you because you're at rest. Most people think of death as at rest, as in, I want to speak to you, be asleep. I'll be asleep. My neshama, my distant cousin, my alter ego, gotta go up there to Shemayim. And according to that, the question I ask those guys is very profound. Do whatever you want, party, do every sin you can imagine. It doesn't matter, because why should you care about your neshama? Says Rabbi Sal Salant that that's a toast, that's a mistake. I am the neshama. When the body is buried, I separate. I stand there in front of Hashem and I answer for everything that I did, right or wrong. And again, this concept is basic, but this concept is very elusive and very hard to feel. And I'd like to share with you a little mashal to sort of help make this easier to remember. I want you to imagine the following. Imagine you're driving, it's Purim, and you're collecting, and the guy who's driving the car had a drink or two too many, and before you know it, you see the shatter of glass, you hear the smash, and you wake up 3 days later in the hospital. The doctor looks down upon you, and you open your eyes, and he says, "Son, you'll never move another muscle again in your body." And you're locked in. You're there, and you're awake, you can't move your arms, can't move your limbs, you're locked in. Here's the question. Are you alive? I'd like to present that you're very much alive. And your buddies come in to visit you and they say, "Oh, you look terrible. Oh, you look horrible. But listen, you know, you can't use your bike, so I hope you don't mind if I borrow it, right? And your iPod, you know." "Hey, listen, buddy, you can't use it now. You know? So, okay, see you later, guy." You want to punch the guy. You can't because I'm locked in. But you are very much alive. There was a book written called The Diving Bell, which chronicles just such a story. A French writer, an editor of the Elle magazine of France, was in just such an accident, car crash, wakes up in the hospital, and the book tells his story. It tells the story of when he opened his eyes and he realized he can't move a single muscle in his body. And it describes what it was like. It describes the nurses who came in. Some were so kind and some so sweet. Some were okay. When he called Attila the Hun, he describes what it was like being there in the hospital bed. He describes when his children came in, how happy he was to see them, but how pained he was because he couldn't touch them. Interestingly enough, he was able to blink his left eye. A speech pathologist devised a method for him to communicate. She put the alphabet on a card. She moved her fingers down the alphabet. When she got to a letter that he wanted to signal, he would blink his eye and she'd write it down. So he was able to speak to the world to tell how he felt. Here's the question, gentlemen. Was that man alive? When he was locked into his body, when he couldn't move his arms, his neck, his head, his chest, he couldn't budge, was he alive? I'd like to present to you that he was very alive. Would you like to know how alive he was? He was so alive that he wrote that book in that state. You see, in the morning, he would compose the sentences and the paragraphs. In the afternoon, his secretary would sit at the foot of his bed and he dictated letter by painstaking letter because he died in that state. That book is a powerful example of how a person is alive despite their body being dead. And I think it's very relevant to us. In 1979, Raymond Moody made effectively a revolution in the world of science. He published a book of near-death experiences. Now, near-death experiences are almost all have these eerie parallels. The person is clinically dead. Their heart stops, and their respiration stops, and no brainwave activity, and they describe popping out of their body, hovering above, seeing things from above. The problem with this book was it was written by a non-religious person who was a scientist, and all it did was bring hundreds upon hundreds of cases of near-death experiences where people saw things when they were dead that they couldn't possibly have seen, couldn't possibly have known, And in the afterwards published now, thousands upon thousands of cases have been reported. Various medical journals bring them down. And I want to share with you two or three of them, just to give you an illustration of what these reveal. Here's a story. A 44-year-old man had a heart attack. The EMTs came to his house, and they brought him into the ambulance, and on the way there, they tried to do the CPR, they tried to do the chest compressions. They couldn't get back a pulse, couldn't get back anything. Effectively, he was dead. They finally got him into the operating room. In the operating room, they put the paddles on him. Before they put the paddles, they took out his dentures. They put the paddles, they somehow got a pulse, and they actually revived him. And a week or so later, he began coming to, and he was, in fact, beginning to recuperate. Okay. When he was recuperating, at a certain point, he asked the nurse in attendance for his dentures. The nurse looked and couldn't find them. She asked another nurse. They asked around. They couldn't find the dentures. They spent days not being able to find the dentures. No one could find them. After about 2 weeks, a nurse who had been there the night he was brought in, who had been on vacation during the interim, came back, and as soon as she walked into the room, he said, "Wait a minute, nurse, you were the one who took my dentures out. Don't you remember? You took out my dentures, and you put them in that little sliding the drawer with the wheels on it. Don't you remember?" The nurse said, "Oh, you're right." And she went, she found that little drawer with the wheels, brought his dentures to him, and here was the point. When his dentures were taken out of his mouth, he was clinically dead. No pulse, no respiration, no consciousness. You could scream at him, he didn't move, he was dead on the table. But he floated out of his body, saw the nurse take his dentures out, and from above witnessed and watched the very eerie sight. Lancet magazine, which is a medical journal which is very prestigious, they wrote up the following article. By the way, I don't know if you know this, but I'm Jewish. And we Jews, I paid money. I heard about this, I read another book, I went online, I paid money to buy this particular journal article because I had to see the words with my own eyes. Let me share with you what the story is. The story is like this. A 38-year-old woman had an aneurysm. She had bleeding in the brain, and the doctors gave up hope. You see, they couldn't operate. Normally, if there's bleeding in the brain, what you do is you open the brain up and you cauterize. You take a heated element and you burn the edges, you sear it together. But the problem is it was so deep in the brain that if they would operate on her, they would effectively cause it to bleed to death. Basically, there was nothing they could do for her. Finally, someone came up with a chop. He said as follows. Theoretically, if we drain all the body, the blood out of a body, there'll be no blood there. We could go into the region of the brain where the bleeding is. We could cauterize the area, seal it up quickly, put the blood back into a body, but there won't be any bleeding during the procedure because there's no blood there. It was quite experimental, very risky. There was no other choice. They presented this option to the woman. She discussed it with various people, including her family. She decides to undergo the operation. Okay. The day of the operation, what they do is as follows. They tape close her eyes and put cotton in her ear. They had to make sure that there was no brainwave activity at all. Any brainwave activity would draw blood, and that blood could cause her to bleed to death. They put her under anesthetic, put her body into a vat of ice. They had to freeze down the body. When her body was fully, fully cold, then they put a syringe into her vein and drew out all of the blood from her body. Then, when there was nothing left, no heart rate, no respiration, no brainwave activity, when all of the blood was drained from the body, a surgeon opened her scalp and went into the brain, found the area of the bleeding, cauterized it, quickly closed it back up, and they put the blood back into her body. And in fact, she survived. After about a week or so, she's beginning to come to, the surgeon who had performed the operation came to visit her, and she turns to the surgeon and goes, "You know, I had the strangest hallucination. Doctor, I must share it with you. While you were operating on me, I felt like I popped out of my body. And I felt like I was hovering on the ceiling. And I was watching you operate on me. And then I saw you took an electric toothbrush. Electric toothbrush. And you tried to put it into my thigh. And you said to the nurse, it won't fit. And the nurse said, try anyway. And you said, but it won't fit. And the nurse said, try anyway. And he said, but I can't. And the nurse said, try. And finally, you tried to get into my thigh. And in fact, you got into the vein of my thigh. Isn't that strange, doctor?" The doctor turned white. because part of the operation involved taking an implement, an instrument that looked something like an electric toothbrush. He had to insert it into a thigh to get it where it needed to be. He tried to put it into the vein, but it didn't fit. He turned to the nurse and said, "Nurse, it won't fit." She said, "Try anyway, it won't fit," back and forth. But here's the problem. This woman saw this when she was stone dead. No heart rate, no brainwave activity, all of the blood drained out of her body. As she hovered above it, saw this, that which she couldn't possibly have seen. And when you read one after another of these, you get this eerie sense of, oh, I get it. I'm not the head, not the chest, not the leg, not even the brain. Gentlemen, I've never been to an autopsy, but I sincerely believe that when they bury the body, they bury the brain with it. You see, you're not even the gray matter from ear to ear. You are the one inside the brain, and you're the one who has to think through this clunky brain. You ever think, you sort of think about something, oh, get a fly, oh, let me sort of think about, what does that mean? I know many, many things that I have to then go through my heavy, clunky, concrete brain to sort of solidify. I do not die when the body is buried. The body is put in the ground, I separate, and I live on forever. When this 80-year-old man heard this, he had one simple thought. And that is that he never thought about this. You see, what I said to that audience was, every moment of your life shapes you. Every time you speak in a kind way or a cruel way, every time you sit down to learn or you don't, every time you get stuck or you don't, changes who you'll be forever. And when my body is buried, I leave. But I doesn't mean my distant cousin, my alter ego. It means I, the one who's speaking, the one who thinks, separates from this body and live on forever. And this 80-year-old reached that conclusion that the majority of the world reached at the end of their life. You know what the saddest words you'll hear? And listen very carefully. If you're not sure of them right, go to the old age home. Listen to the older people when they finally get it. And they say those three expressions, would've, could've, and should've, but didn't. Most people leave this life with deep, deep regrets. Most people don't accomplish a 10,000th of what they could have been. And would you like to know what the single greatest stopping factor is? Of course I would learn. Of course I would grow. Of course I would become a great person, but I can't do it. Based on my background, based on what I'm holding, and based on my brain, I got ADD, ADHD, I can't learn. Can't expect to actually grow and learning and steigen. That's not going to happen. Not in the real world, not me. And this single concept, and that is nonsense, it's not true, and that at some point in your existence, it will be blazingly clear, I could have been a tremendous individual. I could have been a great person. For eternity, I could have been a tremendous, tremendous person. It's a very frightening, scary thought. But time explains that people usually make a mistake. People think, Talmud Chacham, that was Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Shmuel, Abaye and Rava, those were Talmidei Chachamim. But in our day, no such thing as Talmidei Chachamim. It's not anymore. Says the Chacham, would you like to know the definition of Talmud Chacham? A person who is able to paskin halacha in that generation. If you're competent enough to actually sit down to Mishnah Berurah and come out with a definitive understanding of what the halacha is, you reach the level of a Talmud Chacham. Gentlemen, you'd like to know what that means in plain language? If you are bright enough to have passed a ninth grade fraher, then you are bright enough to become a Talmud Chacham. See, Talmud Chacham doesn't mean what you do for a living. I mean, if you're a Rebbe, a doctor, an Indian chief, what you are as an individual. And the single most life-changing thing that you guys can do is to put the brain on and listen during shir. And this is the shocking reality of it. You're all in shir anyway, you're there anyway, and 4 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you're going to look around and you're going to say, oh my goodness, that guy was in shir with me, he battled with me, he did everything. What happened? Because you're looking at him and he became a giant. And if you don't recognize it in 20 years, I guarantee in 40 years, and not in 40 years, then when you leave this earth, you'll see people who you went to yeshiva with, powerful, stellar giants, and you'll say, what happened to him? What happened was a very interesting thing. He put the brain on and began learning and steiging and growing. And the key to it all, gentlemen, is not spending 20 hours a day in the Beis Medrash. The key to it all is getting pshat and shir, focusing the brain, going from back here, to thinking, to understanding what was the kasha, what was the answer, maybe how do you know, maybe it could be the other way, getting it, putting your brain on. The difference between on and sort of on is miles and miles. Now, Harry Brigida said I wasn't going to talk about taiva, and I'm not going to. But I was driving from Muncie to Lakewood with a fellow who asked to talk to me. What's the problem? He said, well, I don't believe in a kosher policy. I'm not sure I believe that what we do is right. So I said, fine. Listen, I'm speaking in Lakewood Sunday night. Come with me, and we'll talk. And this fellow described, he no longer wears yarmulke, no longer wears tzitzits, no longer puts on tefillin. And he describes the reason. He's not sure about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He's not convinced that what we do is right. And he spends about maybe 7 or 8 minutes describing. And after about 7 or 8 minutes, I turned to him and I said, your problem is not HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Your problem is not the Torah. Your problem is not knowing whether this is right or not. Your problem is that she's very pretty. He said, what do you mean? And I told him, isn't it obvious? She's pretty. Yeah, you're right. Oh. And we spent maybe another 13 minutes, maybe 14, and I said to him, forget it. Your problem is very obvious. Your problem is you got involved with a young woman, and you feel broken, you feel destroyed, you feel like a slime, you can't walk into the Beis Medrash, you can't learn anymore, you can't daven, because you feel like a worthless slime. So listen to me, I said, just do one thing. Drop the girl and put back on the yarmulke. Put on tzitzis and put on tefillin. And you may think this is a joke. He said, you're right. And after 40 minutes, I was done. The drive from Muncie, I feel like it was an hour and a half. After 40 minutes, we were done. So I said, okay, let me work on the shmooze now, and you keep driving. Because that was the deal. He had to drive. I had to work on the shmooze. And that was it. It was done. This is not like made up. This is not like a fiction. I didn't write the script here. This was a Maisa Shaya. Today is what, Tuesday? This was Sunday night on the way to Lakewood. Do you understand why this was? Because this guy fell for the biggest trick in the book. The greatest trick of the Sultan is to tell you you're a slime, you're worthless, you're a nobody, and I'll prove it to you. Look what you did. Look at that baby. Look what you did. Ah. You look. Yeah, tell you. Ah. You look. Ah. You slime. You worthless. Okay. David Melech Yisrael fell. But gentlemen, this is the Yisod. And the Yisod is you don't win this battle. You don't win this war called life by throwing a great jab or a great hook. You don't win it with a great jump shot. You don't win it with all the talents in the world. You win it by being a fighter. The Rishiva used to tell us over and over, is the guy a fighter? And you see, if you're a fighter, you win because you get back in the game, you get back in again, you get knocked down, and you get back again. And if you find it's difficult to learn, it's hard to concentrate, you'll find that you're a human being living in the 21st century. There's only one question. Are you willing to get back into the game when you got knocked down? When you got knocked down, are you man enough? Are you valuable enough to yourself? Do you hold of yourself enough to say, I can do it? When Rav Gifter looked in that mirror, he looked at the Gedolim, he said, why not you? And he held of himself. Muhammad Ali held of himself to the extent that he said, it's better to train now and die a champion. These were people who understood. These were people who understood what they were worth. And gentlemen, I guarantee from this room will come quite a number of Tamei Chachamim. The question is, are you one of them? The question is, where do you fit in? Now let me close with one last thought. If you think it's hard at 80 years of age to hear a speech and then come to the realization that everything that you've done up to now has been a waste of your life, if you think it's difficult at that point to realize how you squandered away this greatest opportunity and you didn't have more fun, it wasn't a more enjoyable life, you just blew it, I want you to picture what it must be like for the onion. And when Hashem says to him, do you see Hillel? Look what he became, the stellar giant. Look at that forever, for eternity. Everyone sees him as that. And look at you. At that moment, reality comes crashing through, and the onion recognizes it was a bluff, it was a lie. Every line that I fed myself, it was a difficult generation, and I didn't really like learning, and it wasn't important to me, and I had bad friends, and a bad environment, and I had a different day school, I had a different parent. It's lies, it's nonsense. In that moment it comes crashing through. And gentlemen, one of the beauties of being young is you can change your life. And all it takes is something so simple, putting the brain on, getting shear, hocking your Rebbe till you get, I have to understand, what was the kasha, what was the answer? I have to master shear. You guys don't need to become the biggest masnidim in the Beis Medrash. You need to be the guy who gets the best possible understanding of shear, because at the end of the day, that will change you. You head onto a path, you start growing, you start accomplishing. 20 years later, you're a different human being. 40 years later, you're a different human being. Hashem grant you the wisdom, understanding, opportunity. If you're not aware of the shmooz.com, is a place not to go if you're Ben Torah. Have your mother, your sister go and download the shmooz before you put them on the iPod. If you would like to access the shmooz and you don't have a mother or sister who can do it for you, go on Kol HaLashon. I brought some shmooz that has a number over there, and you don't have to go on the internet. Shkai Hashem.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. What are you guys doing? Mayor Bagley.